Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Through the Tech Vine. So be quiet, pay attention, and get inspired. There is one truth that is not told enough. Technology is not magic, but it can be magical. Technology is human. It is part of who we are, our evolution, our future. Will it be a dystopian or utopian one? Well, that is up to us and nobody else. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Blue Lava is the first business platform for CISOs to manage their security program. Blue Lava guides security leaders to effectively measure, optimize, and communicate their security program with confidence and ease in one platform. Learn more at bluelava.net.
And we're live once again. Shaman, Diana, and one other weird name there, 3D LNX. Sounds like a barcode or something, but
the avatars have three snouts, and then there's one with a weird glass snout.
It's your camera snout.
Now you have to describe that for the people that are not watching this and they're just listening. Come on, I want to know how you describe that.
Yeah, so my avatar has the snout of my dog, who is sniffing a 3D printed dog that I printed because he got a little jealous that there's another dog in the house.
But the 3D printed dog. Good. It's so good that he thought it was a real dog.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. And I want to just announce the guest. For people that didn't recognize the voice, we're talking with Ellen Xu, which is also the host of the podcast on ITSP Magazine named Delta X. And once again, guys, we have a real guest. We don't have to lie.
No,
we don't have to pretend.
We never lie,
but we just tell people, no, we got a lot of guests, we got a lot of friends, but they're all imaginary in the end. So, but today Israel is our second guest, and I have to say that we are starting to line up a bunch on the episode coming up. So get ready for a really, really interesting conversation. I would say Ellen, a couple of words about you for the people that haven't heard your podcast. What's your podcast about, and how did you end up doing that on ITSP Magazine?
Sure. So hi, I'm Ellen. And as Marco mentioned, I'm the host of Delta X podcast. And so, for those of you who don't know, I'm a high school student, and I realized that there's not really that many podcasts around which are talking about what youth are doing, what people my age, what teenagers around the world have been accomplishing to create changes in, technology, innovation, science, all these really amazing things that the next generation are getting into. And so I interview some of these people, some of the coolest teenagers I can find and coolest, Gen Z, to try and see how they're changing the world. And so that's where the name Delta X comes from. We're all about change.
Very cool. Very cool. And Sean and Diana, what generation are we? Do we want to say that?
No.
Yeah. I'm fine with it. I'm Gen X.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Same here.
Yeah. We're the best generation.
Oh, I see.
Don't they all say that?
So I said to my dad the other day, I said something about the boomers, right? And my father was horrified. He's like, I'm the silent generation. And I was like, wow, it's like a touchy subject. He's like,
wait. Okay. The silent generation? I never heard of that.
It was the generation before the boomers and Gen X, that was a sort of low density generation, and the boomers where there were tons of them, right?
Why is it called silent?
I think a lot of them died in the war.
Oh, okay.
And there weren't a lot of them. There were fewer of them. Gen X, we're kind of silent compared to, it's all about the boomers and the millennials and now the zoomers, and we're sort of the forgotten generation. So I think the silent generation was a similar case.
Okay. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. Well, so, Sean, anything special?
I'm special.
That's true.
It depends. Who's Sean am I talking to?
Own definition of special for me, I'm sure. Yeah, well, that's a good question. Which version of me do you get today?
I don't know.
I don't know if there's a rule that it has to be the real me if we have a real guest.
If you pass the Turing test, we're good.
There are no stinking rules, by the way.
My question is, does the real Sean pass the Turing test?
That's the big question.
That's a big question.
We don't know if there is an answer to that.
Sean, are you NP complete is the question.
Next gen, Sean.
Okay.
Next gen, Sean. Okay. Let's get into this business today. It's episode number 17. So imagine that we went that far already. And like I said, we have a wonderful guest. And Sean, as you know, the rule of the game, I guess there are no rules, except that each single one of the person that participate to this, what we call a radio show, that's why you're not even seeing our video, even if you're watching live right now, is the fact that we bring a tech news, and we stretch, I think, the term tech as much that we can. But we bring in news that catch our attention, and we discuss it. We look at it from a different perspective, and I try not to bring the dark side of things. But you know how it is. Sometimes I just go there.
It just follows you around, I think.
It does follow me around.
And I feel like the McDonald's ice cream machines was hard hitting tech that I brought to this conversation.
But it was very tech, right? I mean, there was a follow-up. There was an investigation that started after we talked
It's true. Yeah. It goes into the right to repair. So, yeah. I think we bring tech.
Yeah.
Bird tech.
Sounds like it. Ellen, you know what? Let's break the rule. I want to start with Ellen today with what news she brought, because I kind of have a feeling that the name 3D Ellen, it's giving it away.
Yeah, I think I did give half of the equation away here, but I would be happy to share first.
Yeah, go for it. Let's
All right,
it go.
So, yeah, this news I actually came across yesterday and I thought it was really cool. But scientists have been 3D printing living brain cells using bioprinting.
That's big.
All right.
Yeah.
What are they going to use it for? Why would you do that?
Yeah, I think one thing that they said, although they did point out that they're currently very far from this point, but could be potentially used in the future for like printing organs, and that could be used for like transplants or other types of different surgical uses.
Wow. So that's interesting, because is it with transplants and I'm not a medical doctor, but with transplants, you have to find the right donor because they need to have some sort of genetic match or have some blood type or something. There's a whole process in some transplants to find the correct donor. Would this give them the ability to maybe tweak that so there's no more waiting list for the right donor? Just print it.
That's an interesting idea. Yeah, they didn't talk about it, but I'm sure that there's definitely more customization with bioprinting.
So cool.
So if you do something like that, it made me think, like the other day we talked about when you create meat that has nothing to do with meat, right? Like you're just like doing it in the lab. Are you talking about 3D printing because they manipulate the DNA, the cell? I mean, it doesn't look like this is a 3D printing of material that is not organic, or do you know that, or are we literally talking about printing like an art or liver or something made of material that is not human tissue or recreation of the human tissue? Do you know that?
I'm not sure actually how the science works, but I do know that they printed living mouse brain cells and that they survived for 2 days after. So I guess it's actually dealing with the actual cells.
Wow. That makes me go dark. Should I go dark?
Go for it.
All right.
Are you going to connect mouse brain cells to food, Marco? Is that where you're going with?
No, that would be kind of weird. I'm the first thing that came in my mind was Frankenstein, you know, Dr. Frankenstein and then Frankenstein the monster and the creature. And yeah, how we're really crossing the line of creating life. I mean, that came in my mind as soon as you said they're creating brain. So I don't know if you guys have seen Frankenstein Jr., but that's there is a brain there, if you remember. Ab something?
Normal.
Yeah, exactly. What's your thought, that Sean? Scary or?
On Young Frankenstein? It's probably my favorite.
No, I know that.
Gives you a glimpse into my NP challenged mind. But no, I think brain printing. Yeah, I think as with most of our conversations, if there's a way to give somebody better quality of life or life in general, I think it's great. And maybe not just humans, but animals, our pets and our friends like that. Perhaps there's value for them as well. And I don't know, maybe perhaps it helps with research. I don't know how closely they can match regular brain tissue, but to see their ways to deal with Alzheimer's or cancer cells or memory loss or other things. I don't know. Could be interesting what they do with it.
Yeah, sure it is. Diana, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was thinking that I like the idea around the research because, you know, there's a lot of people get concerned about how we get some of the cells for research. Some research does need to go on, you know, with animals and animal rights activists sometimes, you know, get upset by that. So I like the idea of maybe if we could just grow this, that then it could advance research would be wonderful. And also like what I was saying earlier is that there are a lot of people waiting on lists to get organs. And in some places people will harvest your organs because they're so valuable. And this would be a really, if it could be applied in that, it's probably years away, but if it could be applied to that eventually, I mean, that could be really just change how we do, how we repair people. Although it's kind of interesting.
We repair people.
Yeah. Well, right. It's because it's not quite bionic, but uh-huh. what if you get to the point of, well, your heart wore out, we'll just print you a new one and put it in.
Right. No, I mean, we are kind of already there. I mean, I think there is a lot of people been working on lungs and art that are artificial. And by doing that, the rejection, as you were mentioning before, it's lower. But here we're talking about kind of, from what I'm understanding, like recreating the cell. So then the cell can, I guess, recreate themselves and rebuild the entire. That'd be kind of cool, like regrow an arm or something like that.
I'll be not chameleons. Yeah, like lizards, right?
Yeah.
Tail grows back.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be special, but I don't know. It's a little scary, but eventually I think we will get there for sure.
But the scary is the unknown for me. I mean, what's possible?
Yeah.
Well, the scary for me, Sean, is what you do with that. Like everything, right? I mean, it's a beautiful technology, but then what you do with that? Is it going to be the crazy scientist that is going to create the Dr. Monroe Island and start creating weird creatures, you know?
Frankenstein.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, definitely, Ellen, you made us start with a pretty heavy conversation here.
Yeah, but, bring a little Frankenstein.
Yeah, you brought a little Frankenstein. Sounds always good. And if you haven't read that, it's a good read too. Diana, you want to go with yours?
Yeah, definitely. All right. So do you guys know what 90658 stands for?
I remember that songs in the 80s. That was that phone number.
8675309.
Yeah. So that kind of reminded me of that, but no, I don't know what
Beverly
it's
Beverly Hills 90290.
Is that a zip code?
It's not actually. It's the American Medical Association's CPT or current procedural terminology code for a flu shot.
Oh.
Yeah. And there are apparently 10,000 different CPT codes, over 10,000. And when a doctor sees you, what we interact with them when we talk to the doctor, and we see them jotting down notes in their, you know, they'll jot down notes either by hand, or they'll just, nowadays, most of them just type it in to their computer. And your notes then go into your general health, your EHR, your electronic health record. But the way that you're just tracked is through this CPT code, what was done, right? And there are 10,000 of them. So there's a lot of different things that they can obviously do to you in the healthcare environment. So you'll get a diagnosis, and then you get a CPT code, like they came in for a flu shot, they came in for their annual exam, or obviously there's a lot more when you get into deeper care. But that's the main way that doctors have to track widespread cohorts to understand who's got different kinds of diseases, is they look at the CPT code or the diagnosis. And if anybody who knows someone who's been through a mystery illness and tried to figure out what's wrong with them, getting a reliable diagnosis, you know, that can be a really, really difficult task. If you have something that's unusual, that's not easy, flu shots are easy, right? You go in, you get the flu shot, we know what our CPT is. But if you've got an illness that is hard for the doctor to diagnose, it's also hard for them to understand who else might have that problem or get indicators of what problem you might have if what you're showing up with is sort of complex and a little mysterious and a little difficult to figure out. So doctors have this challenge of they just looking at the CPT codes and trying to find people that have the same problem you do may not give them all of the information that they need. So when they have they need assistance, how do they get that? And a cardiologist named Dr. Matthew Solomon had this idea where he said, you know, all of this rich information is in the unstructured data set. It's in the EHR. It's in the chicken scratch notes that the doctors type down and say, you know, this is what the patient is telling me. But that's unstructured data. It's not indexable. It's not searchable the way that CPT codes would be. So he said, what if we used NLP, natural language processing, to ingest the EHR, the electronic health information, and see if by looking at all of that, the NLP would be able to ID potential diagnoses that were missed by the individual doctor. But when you aggregate all of the kinds of notes across lots of different patients, that you start to see patterns. Could the NLP identify that? So they took a million EMR, electronic medical records, and echocardiogram reports, because there's something else that's structured. And they fed the health record information and the echocardiogram reports in. They also had to this NLP system. And the NLP system, within minutes, which is amazing, because apparently the doctor that did this said that it would have taken years of doctors devoting time to figure this out. Within minutes, the software recognized 54,000 patients of that million that had conditions that appeared to be connected to what they were looking for. And in this case, they were looking for something that was very hard. It's apparently hard to diagnose, which is valvular heart disease, because it's such a complex condition and it can present in so many different ways. So this system said these 54,000 need, you know, a closer look. So that's pretty encouraging. I mean, having worked with NLP before, I know that 54,000 now probably had to be vetted by doctors to see who really had this disease and who didn't. But that hard work of who in those lists with what they presented and what was in their record, who might have something like this valvular heart disease, they were able to come up you narrow that down out of that million and get to 54,000 that hadn't yet been diagnosed that maybe now can be diagnosed. And it also gives the opportunity to take all that unstructured data and turn it back in some ways to something that's more structured in a sense. So it can be, you know, viewed, you can start to get ideas about diagnosis across larger cohorts for these really complex diseases. So it's not some moonshot with cancer solving. I know in the past AI and ML have been said, oh, we're just going to solve cancer with it. So it's not that. It's this very, I like it because it's a very specific applied way to take what the doctors are putting into the records, but be able to use the power of language processing to get some insight out of it.
Very cool. I mean, this is an area that I've spent a little time, not necessarily on the medical end of it, but more of the data piece of it. And yeah, precision healthcare, looking for those specific nuggets of symptoms or attributes of the checkup or some tests or whatever it is, and pulling that together to find a commonality that then can be used to treat others, find trends of new diseases or new symptoms that need to be taken care of. As you can imagine, my view of that or involvement there was around the identification and de-identification of the patients. So it'd be interesting to know, and I don't know if it shares in the article, the research you found, but if they're, one, people don't want to be recognized for having some disease if they're then unable to get insurance. And, but then of course the flip side of that is if they're going to die, it'd be nice to know that there are others that have been treated and perhaps successfully treated, and they would want to know that they have that disease and then be cured. So there's always a flip side or catch 22 there. Precision healthcare, I mean, the ability to find stuff that wouldn't otherwise be found using data and algorithms, certainly really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I am hopeful because I do know a number of people that have had diseases that just a few people have them. It's really hard to track it down. It's very hard to get a diagnosis. So I got pretty excited about the idea of, okay, maybe this will help to pull out every time a doctor writes one thing or another, it's in this sort of this category of space that it starts leading to this diagnosis, and then maybe even crowdsource, because some diseases impact so few people that it's really hard to aggregate the data and learn. So hopefully this will help. I also know that it can be easy to get really excited about what comes out of ML and AI, and then as it gets used with broader groups, the devil's sort of in the details. That it looked really good, you got 50% of the way really quickly, but getting past that can be, getting more accuracy can be really difficult.
Yeah, Ellen, any thoughts on this? I know you look at a lot of different data-driven technologies.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting, and I was wondering too, is this something that could be, you know, used to assist doctors with diagnosis, or is it mainly for, you know, catching those missing patients that have slipped through because, you know, maybe it's not easy to classify? I'm just curious how this might be used in like an actual setting and how it could be leveraged for an AI and doctor like augment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was his initial thing. He's looking to, find patients that have complex conditions that are just, they're the way that they're presenting. It could be because so many different diseases can look like other diseases, and it can be really difficult to figure out which exact one it is. And sometimes there just aren't assays or tests. So I think that was his main point. You know, he was trying to do that initially, but you know, who knows once they start going, because they were starting to think about, you know, like how to create cohorts and you know, look at treatments and see, you know, if treatments are better or worse. But I think it's still pretty, like, this was recent. I think the piece I found on it was just published yesterday. Wow. So I think it's pretty new. Yeah,
but this coding, the coding itself, if I'm understanding, has been going on for a long time, right?
The coding has, yeah. The coding is just sort of an example of this is what if you're a doctor and what structured data can you search? You can look at people who have a diagnosis. You can look up who's been treated for what using this, because that's something that's really easy to pattern match. You know, the CPT code for a flu shot or for treating a heart disease. Then you can start seeing how many people have that. But if for people that don't have a diagnosis yet, it can be really hard to, because it's all in that unstructured data.
Right, right. No, my first thought about this is the fact that there was the code. Well, that's great, but how shareable this code was before, you know, computer networks and artificial intelligence putting together things, and how much the healthcare system between one hospital and the other. I mean, you're still collecting your own record when you move from one doctor to another. So to imagine this community to share all this information, which of course will be incredibly beneficial for patient, not only for for every patient, but in particular for those one that they don't have enough data, as you said. I mean, you could have this super computer depository of all these symptoms, and of course machine learning and artificial intelligence can put it together. So I'd be curious to know what is the benefit of this. What was the benefit of this until
the codes? That's billing. That's how they bill us. It's for health insurance.
There you go. So who gives a shit about the codes for what you got? Because you know insurance is going to read it. Forget the lab research at the at the university. Okay, I'm being sarcastic right now. No.
Finish being sarcastic. Go ahead and say that they're just going to use it to identify who needs treatment so they can treat them so they can make more money.
Ooh. It all comes down to cash.
Always comes to money.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, but well, there are plan-based systems. There are state-based systems. I know they're trying to build a national health data record set. But to your point, Marco, I mean, if the data sets, I don't know, Diana, where the data sets came from, is it multiple places?
It might have been. So this doctor, he's at Kaiser Permanente, so they would have a lot of records.
That's in that plan then. Yeah, the Kaiser.
Yeah, it may have been just in that plan. Yeah.
Well, we can bring the former CEO of Kaiser Permanente. That I interview one time, I'm sure I have an opinion on that.
He's
pretty open on on criticizing the system. So really cool person. We'll see if he's available. But then, you know, before we jump to the next topic, I like to make the connection with the privacy, right? So on one side, you have the necessity. Let's forget the billing. Let's live in an ideal world right now where we share this information. We're able to anonymize it when it goes into the depository, but then there is a code to retrace the patient in case that a good discovery has been done. So on the other hand, you know, you need to give the okay to share your record. One hospital structure it's probably not sharing with another one, like I said before. So that crowdsourcing of finding cures, you know, I think it's hitting with the legal. And I don't know, Sean, you probably know a little bit about this as well. But
yeah, I was alluding to that earlier. I mean, as soon as you can tie an identity back to a set of data, especially this type of data, it becomes very risky, very challenging. And
but if you have a disease that is debilitating and you know that you could, it's kind of like participating to a research group, right? then when you're like, okay, I'm going to be part of the research group, and if something come up, you know, I give the okay to use my data for finding the cure for something. Or so I guess what I'm saying is, if the benefit, it's more than the risk of losing your privacy data, I guess, I don't know, I would probably take the risk.
Yeah, and they may already, I mean, because it's an interesting question, because if sharing the CPT code is a problem, because that would already be in the system, then you know what the people are treated for. There's already privacy and controls around that. But yeah, like if you got thrown into this group of that where your EMR or EHR is being searched and you don't want it, then that could, because there's a lot of other stuff in there. So maybe they're going to identify you have this valvular heart problem, but you could have also told your doctor about some emotional problem that you're going through because of stress at work that you really don't want to have out. So it is a good question. Is it now going to be, and that I don't know.
Yeah. Well, there's always that debate between the benefit of something and the risk of something. Yeah. We had that conversation with the Electronic Frontier Foundation about the Green Pass and how when you scan a code, you can find so many more information than just the fact that you got the vaccine from, you know, where are you located, your name and other data that may be used against you in a nefarious way. But at the same time, that, you know, if you could isolate that data, then I think it's a good thing. But you always have to think about, the bad people try to take advantage of that, and that kind of sucks. But that's where we are.
Privacy by design is the great Anne Kavoukian, laid it out for us. So
absolutely.
Yeah, it's three conversations on their own in this topic, Ellen.
Ellen, would you like to add something to this, or do we move to the fermentator?
Yeah, well, I'm definitely interested to hear what the fermentator is about. But I was wondering with healthcare, I know there's as we've mentioned, there's so many privacy, concerns with this. And I was just wondering, is there an estimated timeline where we might be actually seeing this in use? Or I don't know, what are your thoughts on when this might actually be something that can be applied in hospitals?
Well, this guy, he ran this test already. So
really?
He's done this research. Yeah, they already ingested the million. They did a million records and they came out with 54. They ID'd 54,000 patients that they believe have that they're going to, their next steps, I hope that they're going to bring them in and maybe see if that's the right diagnosis. But
I see. So that was a clinical trial?
Yeah, well, it was a trial that he was allowed to run at Kaiser,
Oh, that's promising. All right.
Yeah. Well, let's hope it's going to happen soon and everybody agree on a way to to do it right.
That's my final thought, and that is did the people opt into that? I remember getting a message through my doctor's portal asking if I still wanted to share the data. I'm like, well, I never said I agreed to that in the first place. So why are you confirming it?
Again, it could be if it's all Kaiser, it's all within the Kaiser Permanente system. It could be that it's not, there's not a HIPAA problem because they agreed to allow Kaiser to use it as they needed within the system. I don't know. That level was not in the article.
Yeah.
These are good questions.
And who knows? Yeah, and this wasn't Kaiser, but who knows? Maybe they spun off a division or acquired a division or partnered with, I don't, who knows why it was prompted, but. The language was that I was already sharing it, and I never agreed to.
Yeah, because there's no privacy by design, that's for sure. If you didn't opt out, you were opt in. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah, and it was.
I'm wondering if we should have a drink. Is the fermentator about a drink here, or
toast?
Do whatever you want. It's not going to be.
Oh, really? Okay.
It is delicious, though. And So I touched on this a little bit last. It was one of the 30 moonshots for a better world and positive climate. And it's a topic that I love, which is food. So beverage mining might fall in there too. So I'm not going to get too much into the tech. It's about fermentation and creating and growing new things instead of harvesting and killing other things. So it's rooted in fermentation. It's microbe based foods, right? So the idea is that we can grow things without having to set up big farms and we can grow it in the place where it needs to grow versus transporting all over the place based on where it can grow for the weather and things like that. And so the article that I came across, and I'm hoping this will stir a little conversation, that there's companies creating dairy products. I think we talked about that one, right, Diana? Fake non-dairy ice cream. There's meat, there's eggs, all these things. And the article talks about how do you present this to people? And I touched on this a little bit last week, I think it was, what's the adoption going to be like? Can we get people over the hump of the status quo and just doing the same thing because it's always been done that way? And this article talks about how do you sell food that isn't food people are used to, that it's a cow, but not really. And then they talk about this company's website that they're recreating food and delighting the taste buds. And they're showing a picture of a cow, but talking about creating something that tastes like that through the magic of microbes that isn't really a cow. And so there's two parts to this. And I guess how much of the this may be a bad analogy or a thing to say, but how much of the sausage making do consumers need to know to make this choice of doing something that they would have otherwise done all their life? And how much of that process needs to be abstracted and marketized, if you will, in language and words and visuals that maybe trick us into thinking we're doing the same thing just to get us over that hump that we're stuck on, because that's how we've always done it. So I don't know, Diana, I think you, each time this has come up, you have a lot of experience in some of these things. Marco, I know you dabbled in it as well. So I don't know, in terms of the tech, what you think about it and thoughts on the marketing versus sausage making exposure. This is how microbes and fermentation works and cell-based, plant-based, make it taste like a cow technology works.
Yeah, you know, so I think that people, there are always going to be the scientists that want to know exactly what happens. And we've had like proteins made out of mushrooms for years. They've been on the market. It's sold under the brand name Quorn, Q-U-O-R-N-E, but it's a mushroom protein. And the one that I had brought, the non-dairy dairy, which is it's in such a weird space that there's not even a way to represent it properly on the food labels. So it's listed as whey protein because it's a real milk protein, but it's created from plants and fermentation, and then cows had nothing to do with it, but it has to show up as whey, but you can also put vegan on. So it becomes, we're in like such a weird space, I think, right now, as people are figuring this out. But I think that most people that are doing the eating, they don't really want to go down a deep dive on how stuff is made or what, you know, what's fermented in which vat. I think what they really want to know is, most people just, does it taste good and what does it cost? And then some people will want to know the parts about, well, it's an animal isn't involved, whether their animal rates welfare is their concern, or the climate, for example, or maybe a combination of both. But I feel like in general, you know, to engage people, that it's going to be about the taste and the experience and a lot less about the science for the bulk of the buyers. And certainly there are going to be some people that are always interested in the science, which is great. But I think if we're going to turn hearts and minds of the average eater, that we've really got to go for this tastes good. Yeah, it tastes good and it's not ridiculously expensive, because in a lot of cases right now, unfortunately, the really good analogs that are vegan are more expensive than if you just go and buy the meat. I had somebody say that to me the other day. They're like, you know, it's crazy because there's like vegan eggs now. Different companies have different options. And you know, someone said to me, you know, it's ridiculous. Why would you pay more for a plant-based egg? And I just get the dozen when it's on sale at the market for 99 cents. I can't afford the plant-based egg. And that's...
You can't win that conversation.
Yeah, I agreed.
I've tried. I've tried. Trust me.
Well, there's the whole GMO and organic. It took years to kind of establish that. And I don't know where it sits in terms of how many people buy organic versus not, or GMO versus not. But this kind of fits, it seems to fit in that same realm. I don't know, Ellen, do you have any experience or thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I actually had one of those plant-based eggs the other day. So it's interesting. It's cool to see that people are trying to make them taste more similar, like probably healthier. And I agree. I think it's really like the only way people are going to actually buy these alternatives is if it actually tastes and has like even the same like textures or like the same. I heard that like Impossible, like the company is trying to make their like meat patties even sizzle and smell the same way as like a normal patty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, it's weird because if you don't like meat, it gets to the, I can't eat Impossible because it's got soy in it. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, it's my partner can, and it's a little bit disturbing. If you don't like meat, you're smelling the meat.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like one of my vegan friends won't even eat like vegan meat because it just tastes so much like the actual thing.
Yeah. We're never going to win that battle.
Yeah, no, it's
not
true.
Now you're not eating the vegan meat because it's too similar, but you know, it's not meat, so.
But yeah. The people that are already eating plant-based, right, we're not trying, well, if you care about animal welfare, about the environment, it's about getting people who say, oh, I could never eat that, it's gross, you know, it's not a real burger, that they're the ones that I think that we're really trying to get with those analogs that are so duplicative that it really emulates the...
Yeah, I think what Ellen said, the comment about your friend, it's it can open an entire new can of vegan worms, because some you have to look at the angle, and I leave that in my house, and also I try, honestly, I don't eat as much meat as I used to. I don't even remember the last time I had red meat, for example. I eat fish here and there, and I love, to be honest, I love the Impossible Burger. But when I eat it, here's my dilemma is, I love vegetables, right? So I like, one thing I try to buy is all organic, because I can honestly tell the difference in the flavor. So people that say, no, I'm gonna get the 99 cents whatever versus the other, if you can't afford it, I understand that. I can't commit with that, but if you say an egg is an egg or meat is a meat or whatever is whatever, then I'm Italian, I'm gonna get Italian on you and on the food. Right? So I'm like, I have had burger that are, I don't know, quinoa and beans that are so tasty, and they don't taste as meat. They just taste like a vegetarian burger, and they're good in its own way. But when I eat the Impossible Burger, I feel like I'm really eating a real meat. And that's kind of, I'm like, what is in here? Am I eating something that is good for me or is not?
Well, that's the question I have. Cause I mean, and that's why I brought up the GMO and the organic labeling. Yeah. And I mean, Now, granted, pesticides and things that are really nasty and bad and horrific processes used to change the way a plant grows. But then, I don't know, this seems like completely changing the way something grows, but that's okay. And I'm not saying it's not okay or is okay. But it just seems weird that we're in this marketing struggle of trying to do something good, presumably for the environment.
Right. And let's go there. Right. Yeah. I mean, your question is, you know, do we need to use marketing to do it in a certain way? I mean, I think that the option is, yes, it's good for you, but mostly it's good for the environment. If you watch a couple of documentaries where you see that a lot of the climate change and emission, it comes from agriculture, when you understand that, you know, to grow a cow, it takes more food than it would take to feed people that are eating vegetarian, you would understand that there is a big difference in that. And at the end of the day, you can make the decision based on whatever motivates you, but you also don't think that sometimes you eat some crop that you don't even know what is in there. from antibiotics to colorant back in the 80s to processed food to stuff that you don't even know what it means when you read the you know
what the, is formaldehyde anyway.
It's going to be interesting too about and that's why some of the what they're doing in the lab grown meats, because in some cases it's really about replicating the amino acid and other nutritional profiles and macros specifically. So as everybody knows, I have dogs and cats are obligate carnivores. And we read a ton about people that said they had vegan cats. And I know there are some people who out there that swear, but we never quite got to the point that we felt comfortable even trying it with the cats. Dogs are omnivores, not obligate carnivores. So we did try vegan with the dogs, and we tried a number of different brands, but one of our dogs has a zinc absorption problem. And no matter what we did and gave him extra special, like supplements, because of the zinc absorption, basically his nose leather just came off and it was bloody and raw. So bottom line, our pets eat meat. And of course, if you go to a vet with a problem like that, the first thing they say is take them off the vegan diet. You're an idiot. I would love it if we could get to the stage where it was going to not just have that taste, but that it would be the same for people, you know, if they're going to start making it, if it can be the same nutritionally, because that way we could really revolutionize the pet food industry.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think in the end, it comes down to, I don't know, eat everything with moderation. Meaning, if one time you feel like eating a really good meat and you enjoy and you don't have the animal issue and you think it's grown in the way it's supposed to and as the good old days and not in an industrial farm and all of that, I would say if everything would think that way, it wouldn't be a problem. But when you hear things like the request of meat actually now is went higher than lower, Then I'm kind of worried about it, you know.
So the trend is up in eating meat, is that what you're saying, Marco?
That's what I heard. What has been heard, that the price went up because there is actually more requests for meat. Something like China and other countries are consuming more. And we're not really listening to what we should listen to. And that's probably a problem. But as far as the marketing goes, yeah, I agree. I mean, if it tastes good, people are gonna enjoy it. I mean, there is so many places right now that they are giving, and these are the McDonald's, the fast food. I don't know if McDonald's has Impossible Meat, but I know, a couple of other large chain they do, and that means that there is request. If we want to talk about money, they wouldn't do it if there wasn't the money involved in it, right? So people are eating it and they're liking it. I sometimes I made the joke that I'm like, if you didn't know that this was not real meat, you would think it's a good meat. And that's the scary part for me. So, Alan, what's for dinner?
Maybe an Impossible Burger?
There you go. Okay, I have a question that is connected to my, I guess, my nickname today, Bugs Bunny. Apart from being one of my favorite, you know, characters.
Are you in Florida or Pismo?
I should have taken a left turn at Albuquerque. So that's I don't know where I am. I'm definitely lost right now. But would you eat bugs?
If they were vegan or just bugs?
No, not bugs bunny. Organic, not bugs bunny. Real bugs. Because you know, they say bugs are, you know, bugs are full of protein and vitamins and stuff like that. So I don't know. Have you tried? Any of you have tried to eat bugs? And would you?
So I can't be an entomophagist because I have a severe allergy to exoskeleton-y kind of bugs. So I have problems with fleas. I can't eat shellfish. I go into anaphylaxis. So unfortunately, crickets are off the menu for me.
So you got that out of your indecision list.
Yeah.
Ellen, how about you? Have you ever tried it?
I have not tried a bug before, unless if I ate one when I was younger and I just forgot. But
maybe biking or running, that's when you ate one, but those are not the good ones.
Yeah, maybe a fly. That's funny. I'm not sure actually. I would try it. I would be interested. I know at the zoo sometimes they have like crickets.
Hmm.
I'm not sure if I would want it as like a meal or like want it consistently, but I'd be interested to try it out.
Hmm. Sean, I know you tried everything because I've been in everything. Singapore with you, so I know everything.
I'll try it. I don't care. I have actually eaten the ass end of an ant.
Ass end of an ant? How big was that ant?
Not the whole ant.
Big enough you hold it and grab just that part with the teeth.
And this wow, but it's a big ant. Where are you, like, where? In Australia or something?
Exactly. That's exactly
where I was. Giant Australian ants.
I was.
These Aussie, they eat everything.
And evidently, the Aborigines eat it to. It's like a decongestant, antihistamine.
Wow.
So it helps with allergies and things like that. So and then the other thing I learned is, so evidently you eat the ants and it keeps you breathing clearly, and then you use their nest and you set it on fire and it keeps the mosquitoes away.
Oh,
there you go.
Not a very good idea.
You don't throw away anything. Everything is exactly. Everything.
So I have eaten an ant, but I'd not had ant or bug based protein foods, which
what did it taste like?
It was
sorry, like chicken.
It was like a sour gummy.
Really?
not that
like a wine gum,
like liquid sour gummy.
Okay. So you kind of popped and like oozed when you
not that big. It's just like a little about the size of.
I don't think that counts. I'm talking about a good, you know, instead of spaghetti or linguine pasta, you have a dish of
meal of grubs.
A meal of bugs treated and cooked the right way. I don't know. I haven't tried. But I would probably want to try eventually if I know somewhere they make it right. But here's the last question.
You can buy bars, Marco. You can buy bars that are made with cricket protein.
Right.
You
can buy protein bars. Okay. Yeah. Well, but that's not going to taste like cricket. I want to taste the cricket, which I have.
No, maybe they have cricket flavored versions.
Unsweetened.
Yeah, unsweetened.
Let's put it this way. I don't want to be the one cooking it. I would want to be done, you know, from people that have really been experimenting. And I don't know. I think it's a good solution, but we'll see. Now, the bug that I'm talking about.
I don't think so, Marco.
No. Listen, before we get to the mark, I went all the way around, but I wanted to talk about another kind of bug. Because in my history of tech news, on September 9th, 1945, operators of the Harvard Mark II, which was a computer where Grace Hopper actually worked on the programming of it, they found a moth trapped in the relay number 17 in panel F. And that bug is taped to the troubleshooting log, where it was written, first actual case of bug being found. And even if this was not the first time that they used the term bug for a computer problem, it was the first time that it was not only the bug, but they actually stick the moth on the paper that they found in the computer. And the reason why I bring this up is because, and this is probably a conversation for some other time, but apart from being a piece of history, bugs are a big issue in computers, and I want your opinion if you think that with the way we code now and way that we have to check the software and everything, we can reduce eventually the presence of bugs, or if it's related to human error most of the time, and we're never gonna get rid of human error. So, Diana, what do you think?
Oh, this is a big, big problem.
I know. You got 5 minutes all for yourself.
I don't think it's human error per se. I mean, it does happen that you get developers who make mistakes in the code, but I think it's really just more the massive complexity of the systems that we're creating right now, and the numbers, the amount of code, the intersections of the different components in the code that we're using, so that when you start overlaying them with each other, you find vulnerabilities within different features and functions of the total of the whole. So yeah, we can get developers, if we incent them to and help train them, they're going to be able to write code more defensively, but there are going to be vulnerabilities, and when we have great testing, but there are going to be vulnerabilities regardless. It's just what I think what we really can focus on is reducing the number of them and also making them cheaper to address, because Barry Bohm from IBM came up with Bohm's Law years and years ago. But the bottom line is that the earlier you can find a problem, the cheaper it is to fix. So think about like with the house. If you wanted to draw a house on a napkin, right? And you decide, oh, I'm going to add an extra a bedroom or whatever. You're fine, great. You just get a new napkin, you draw a new version of it. Once you've built the house, adding that bedroom is going to be very, very expensive. And it's the same thing with software. So I think we can do a lot better than we're doing. We can take it a lot more seriously, but we're never going to get to zero.
Because complexity is going to create more options for...
Yeah. And we're even seeing that with like low code, no code now, where people are knitting together different functions, different SaaS environments and functions with it. Like Zapier that you guys use that... As you were creating these very Frankenstein-y complex systems, and even though one may not have a bug, when you start layering together, you find some vulnerabilities in how they're used. So it's a big, big problem, but it's certainly worth working on, because we depend on software for almost every part of our lives right now, and we can certainly do a better job of software security than we're doing.
Mm. Ellen, what do you think? You do some coding, right?
Yeah, I do a bit. The first thing that came to my mind was OpenAI Codex, which is, if you haven't heard of it, like the GPT-3 code writing, like kind of like addition to an IDE, I assume, or some other coding workflow. And it basically can, if you give it a comment or like a to-do, it can generate some code for you based on all of its training on like terabytes of code and GitHub and all of that repository training. And it can help both fix up your code and also write new code. And yeah, I'd be interested to hear how like that might be used to combat a lot of the bugs that we as humans might miss.
Or create new ones if it doesn't, because it translates, yeah. you basically speak what you want to it in natural language and it generates code out of it. But yeah, that'll be interesting to see if it's starting to, now we're going to like have systems create their own vulns or not. But yeah, that's a good point.
Sean, would you eat a computer bug?
Well, I've eaten many. Probably grew some as well. But I think I'm hung up on the term bug. And I know I like the history of where it came from. But to me, a lot of what we talked about here thus far, and I know we're saying it's not just human error, but it's human-created stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's been architected and built to do some things, not other things, and perhaps even more things that nobody ever thought about could be possible. What frightens me is kind of this last point that Ellen brought up and that Diana touched on, which is think about what bugs really are. They're not human-created things. They're living beings that... In some, remember we had the cicada infestation. We've had locusts. They have a mind of their own. They have a society of their own. They have their own things that they do. And when the software and the computer environments really get bugs that live and exist on their own without any human interaction, that's when I get a little frightened. Not to take it to the Marco's dark side, but.
No, you already went there, so you're not
You brought the bug thing, so
yeah.
So I think.
So how would you call it if bug is not?
No, I think it probably is. I'm afraid for what that really looks like. I don't.
So you're saying, just to sum it up, that like a bug give you that idea that it's something that it could corrupt, like not just a string of code, but an entire system, and it kind of propagate and infest. Wow. Okay. So that would be like artificial intelligence that goes bad because of that bug. There are sci-fi books.
Never stops talking to the machine and creating code.
That's what a lot of nightmare sci-fi books are made of. I think actually Asimov used the word bugs in the 50s in one of his robots, the one kind of berserk. So, all right. I think we hit the hour and 1 minute and 38 seconds. And this could be a conversation that we could develop a little bit, like talking about what goes wrong. When just one little thing goes wrong, I mean, based on Sean, what you said, it could grow exponentially to become not just a bug problem, but a really big problem.
In that system, just as an example, in that system, one bug could be introduced by that AI, mm-hmm. and then the next 200,000 instances of the code creation that follow could use or introduce that same bug, if you will.
This happens when people use components and libraries. Like, remember back when Heartbleed, right, which was the zero day in OpenSSL, and it turned out it was in just hundreds of thousands of products. So yeah, you're right. That has happened. You introduce a vulnerability into a well-known component or library, it can be in a lot of places.
Sean, should we call it off?
I'm just going to go eat.
That's why we need to have better rigor around how we design and code. You know, there are a lot of great tools that can help. It's just really, I think that we need to have the will to spend the time and effort. As long as we reward developers for speed and features and functions and not for resiliency and reliability, then they're going to go for speed, right? So... We can do it.
All right. Well, great conversation. We went all over the places, I think.
It was great to have Ellen on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you so much for allowing me to join in. This was a lot of fun.
Yay.
Well, we hope you're going to join us again, and we wish you the best of luck and keep doing the amazing content that you're doing on the on Delta X podcast. And we're the biggest fan, and we are we're family. So we support each other every time that we can.
Thank you so much. And I would love to join on another time if you'd be willing to have me in the future.
Sorry, I had to do that.
Now you're obligated to do that to all folks.
I don't know if I can find it. Because now YouTube is showing some other weird stuff. So,
what was that?
It was, what's up, Duck?
Bugs Bunny.
Oh. All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. And come back again every Thursday at noon Pacific. And we will have more guests and more conversation and more tech, more tech or non or bugs or whatever is coming your way. So peace out, Sean. I think you can push the big red button.
I'll wrap this one. Thanks, everybody.
Blue Lava is the first business platform for CISOs to manage their security program. Blue Lava guides security leaders to effectively measure, optimize, and communicate their security program with confidence and ease in one platform. Learn more at bluelava.net. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Through the Tech Vine podcast. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.